This is the Porno Cultures Podcast, the show where we think about pornography rather than just react to it. To the Porno Cultures Podcast. In this episode, we try to rediscover and reevaluate an ambiguous figure within pornography's history, the Los Angeles-based filmmaker Pat Rocco. Rocco came to my attention a couple years ago when I was lucky enough to see a screening of his 1969 film Ron and Chuck in Disneyland Discovery. In the film, two young men find themselves cruising each other in the family-friendly confines of Disneyland. After eyeing each other for a while, they spend the day together, sharing cotton candy, going on rides together, and even holding hands without any concern for the judgmental glances they receive from their fellow straight park-goers. The excitement of the film comes from the fact that it was actually shot in Disneyland. In many ways, this is gay guerrilla filmmaking at its finest. Eventually, the two boys find an isolated wooded area of the park where they disrobe and frolic naked with each other. They do not have sex on screen. This portion of the film was obviously shot in a separate location. What enthralled me so much about this movie was the way in which it was able to be simultaneously so saccharine, sweet, romantic, and innocent, while also featuring full frontal nudity and dramatically subverting the wholesomeness of Disney. After seeing this, I was very interested in learning more about Rocco. And the more you learn about Rocco, the more you realize the degree to which his legacy is defined by the fact that he was caught in a strange in-between space where an emergent gay rights movement was looking to be taken seriously and respected by the masses in the late 1960s and the era of hardcore pornography in the early 1970s, where both gays and straights were exploring less respectable sides of their sexual desires together via big screen pornography for the first time. In many ways, Rocco embodies both of these impulses, and as a result, he produced a very dynamic, political, highly romantic, and sexual films capturing a wide range of the gay experience during this time. Examples of this include him shooting a gay nude dance party in an LA bar called El Segundo. However, while he was filming, the bar was accosted by police officers looking to bully and intimidate the patrons. Instead of stopping the filming, Rocco continued shooting the scene as officers checked the patrons' IDs and arrested the bar's owner. In the film that was eventually titled Meat Market Arrest, Rocco looks directly at the camera and declares, "I think it's another example of what might be considered by some people, and I think I would venture to say certainly my own opinion, a form of police harassment." Rocco's political imperative intersecting with his sexual impulse is also evident in his 1976 film titled We Were There, where he shoots the happenings that are going on at that year's gay pride celebration in LA. While most of the film documents the PG activities of the party, including a march and entertainment from circus animals for the kids, there's also an equally innocent scene of a parade goer giving a friendly handshake to a nude passerby's penis. This mixture of wholesome fun and sexual desire is a primary aspect of Rocco's films that much of porn fails to capture. Looking back at his work might help us imagine new avenues for pornography's future. In this episode, I'm joined by Matthew Hipps, who is a PhD student in film studies at the University of Iowa, and Brian Wiest, who's a graduate of UCLA's Cinema and Media Studies PhD program. Each of them have written about Rocco's work and have seen some of the films that haven't been seen by the public in decades, so they're able to give us unique insights into the life and career of Pat Rocco. Unfortunately, Rocco died in 2018, just 7 months after we recorded this interview. So what follows is our loving tribute to the wonderful work of Pat Rocco.
So we're here in Toronto at the Society for Cinema and Media Studies Conference, and it just so happens that there were two papers about a gay filmmaker who was making gay films in the 1960s. His name is Pat Rocco. So I have both of the people that worked on their films, and they'll talk a little bit about the history of Pat Rocco, the kinds of films that he made, and there was a highly sexual element to them because there was nudity and also kind of a gay political imperative in there as well. So this is kind of a pre-hardcore understanding of what gay male nudity was at the time. So Matt, why don't you introduce introduce yourself, where you're going to school, and what kind of stuff you're working on.
Thanks for inviting me, Brandon. My name is Matthew Hips. I'm at the University of Iowa, third year graduate student, and most of my work is currently in early film history, convergence of film and theme storytelling, but I've recently been doing work in leisure culture and extending it to the history of cinema, technology, and exhibition and reception. As a side from that, I've kind of fell upon Rocco's work recently, coming through Disneyland Discovery, his film, and really enjoying a lot of his work, so that's where I'm at right now.
I know you grew up in Florida, so you're a big fan of Disney.
And this is Disneyland, though, his film, yeah.
All of our work winds up being personal in some way. Brian, what about you?
Hey, my name is Brian Wiest, and thanks also for the invitation. I just finished my PhD at UCLA in Cinema and Media Studies, and my dissertation was about niche LGBT distribution companies. So thinking about queer film, not as textual analysis, but as industry studies, and thinking about how these distributors have been part of naming LGBT as a category of media, like it's a genre. And yeah, I also kind of stumbled upon my Pat Rocco work when I was just looking at the One Archives for a historiography class. And for me, it was also the question of categorization. I wanted to look at how he was part of naming gay film in the late 60s, early 70s, and separating it from other, like porn or avant-garde, other places that we had seen queer filmmaking.
Yeah, because I think if you were to look at Pat Rocco's films today, you would kind of have trouble figuring out how to categorize them. They're not pornographic enough to masturbate to, yet they're not political enough to start a riot or anything. So could you talk a little bit about the One Archive? Because they're based in UCLA, correct?
Yeah, USC, actually. It's not at USC, but it's owned through them. And I think it's the biggest paper archive of LGBT materials in the U.S. And they have a ton of really interesting stuff. They have a whole library of gay pulp novels from the 50s. They have a lot of physical archives of drag queens' gowns and Leatherman's chaps and stuff. They have this sign that was in Barney's Beanery until 1984. There was this restaurant, and actually Pat Rocco documented this restaurant called Barney's Beanery in West Hollywood that had this sign since the 60s, maybe 50s, that said faggots stay out, and faggots was spelled wrong. And it was hung in there kind of as a joke, but kind of as a serious thing, and it became really just iconic of the bar. And in 1970, Pat Rocco went in and there was a protest around it, and he documented it. He was often documenting gay rights stuff around LA. It's called Sign of Protest is the film. And he goes in and talks to them and is like, why do you have this sign? They would print it on their matchbooks. It was like their iconography. And in 1984, when West Hollywood became its own city, the newly elected mayor went in and took down the sign. And it was like her movement of, now this is like a gay place and we're taking this sign down. So they have that sign in the One Archive. That's all to say. They have like a lot of really interesting physical stuff too.
Now, you've done more extensive work on Pat Rocco. Could you fill us in on his biography? Where did he grow up? What's his background? Anything you can tell us about who he is as a person?
Before he was making films for the Park Theater, where most of his films were shown in LA, he got into it because he answered an ad in the newspaper to be a freelance physique photographer, like still photographer. And after he had done that for a little bit, he started bringing his camera to the sessions, and he would film the models there and make little 8mm films and eventually 16mm films.
What years was this around? And is it kind of similar to the films of the Athletic Modeling Guild, which just had muscle men doing kind of things on sets and just showing themselves off?
So I haven't seen these early films by him, but what I've read about them, it's very much just like posing strap films, very much like AMG or early Dick Fontaine. And yeah, once he had like a bunch of them, then he started trying to sell them. He placed an ad in the LA Free Press, some independent newspaper in LA. And yeah, after there was interest in it, he produced his own little catalog. I mean, Bizarre Productions was his company. He also owned like a coffee shop.
Bizarre.
That's like part coffee shop and then part, I think, what we call a head shop now. And he would screen movies there. So he kind of had this whole little industry. Yeah, once he was selling those films, the managers at the Park Theater, which were looking to move into showing gay film as opposed to the straight nudie cuties because the market had been flooded by that in the early 60s. So yeah, they showed his film in their very first festival, a most unusual film festival it was called, that was like all this gay stuff, in June and July of 1968. And his name wasn't attached to it. It was just the title was there and an image, but it was really popular. And then following that, he became really emblematic of that festival. And his name was always a big part of the advertisement to be like, here's the next thing Pat Rocco's doing, the beautiful boys that he's bringing to you and that kind of stuff. Where he's from, that stuff I don't know off the top of my head. I actually kind of think he's from Florida, and his name isn't Pat Rocco. That's like a name he took. He has like a much more Italian name.
So how did he fund some of these films? I mean, was he independently wealthy, or what was his funding mechanism?
Perhaps from Bizarre, his coffee shop, and some of the funds he produced there being placed into a film network. But also his connection with the Park Theater seems to be pretty important. So having the catalog out and available would have been a place where he's getting resources or funds as people are purchasing purchasing these short nudie films, but the Park Theater becomes aware of these nudie films and wants to then give him a public exhibition space, so he collects the best that he's got and sets them up here. Then they engage with him further and say, you know, we need some more material, we'd like to work with you in the future. So I really think that his Park Theater connection is pretty important to that early funding. And then he does branch off later on, 69, 70, 71, with even One Ink commissioning work for him to journey with a group on a tour, or to shoot in Rio de Janeiro, shoot material to show more interesting works, maybe more exotic works, problematic works, in the Park Theater at the time.
So, Matt, what was your first encounter with Pat Rocco, and what struck you about the film and made you want to look further into him?
I think the humor of Pat Rocco's films is what first made me interested in his work. I think his Pat Rocco Dares film series, it's just a collection of a lot of films, some of them maybe 5 or 6 minutes in length, but then they're dotted in between each short film with small commercials making fun of late 1960s and early 70s culture that commercials are trying to imbibe. In that respect, there are a few advertisements with nudity that he's remaking, all gay male, making fun of the products as well, and he's placing those into the series. So I think there's just the humor of how he goes about curating his own works and then showcasing them is pretty interesting to me at first.
Almost like a gay version of a Saturday Night Live commercial parody.
It was exactly that. In fact, that's exactly what they look like.
So, Brian, what about your first encounter with Pat Rocco, and what struck you about it?
My first encounter was, I think this is a lot of people's, Disneyland Discovery, which UCLA showed it as part of an orphan filmmaking program of films you haven't seen and don't have distribution, that kind of stuff, because UCLA has his films at the archive. And yeah, Disneyland Discovery, it's one of his best-known films, and it's these two pretty boys, what are their names?
I think they're called Adam and Steve.
Chuck and Todd.
Chuck and Todd. And it's these two boys who meet at Disneyland in Anaheim. It uses Disney music, like When You Wish Upon a Star, over top of this, to really romanticize it. Yeah, and they meet and they just do cute stuff around Disneyland. They hold hands, get cotton candy and stuff together. And then they go to Tom Sawyer Island, I think. He's filming it somewhere else, but he spliced it in there that they're then naked and frolicking through the woods. Disneyland stopped allowing tripods in their park because some gay filmmaker had like filmed some gay fantasia by setting up tripods in their park. So it had like a real effect on how Disneyland even allowed things to be filmed in the park.
Yeah, you were allowed to bring in a camera, just not bring in a tripod. It's a silent movie. It's a beautiful little funny movie.
And I think the guerrilla filmmaking aspect of that is pretty important. And he's under the guise of making home videos. He's asking these two young boys to come and pretend to be cruising each other. And I think just telling each other or friends, oh my gosh, you have to see this Disneyland Discovery film, is how I got wind of it. And I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be subversive. This is going to be political. This is going to be really interesting. Cruising, I can't wait to see this. And it ends up, when you're watching it, so cheesy, romantic, and beautiful, but not as controversial as one might expect.
Subversive, though.
Sure, of course. Yeah, definitely subversive. Definitely trying to take on Disney. I've talked with Rocco about this in the past over phone conversations, and he was kicked out of Disney. The lawyers threatened to sue, but the publicity would have been more than Disney would have wanted in the first place and would have actually been a boon for Rocco's film. So unfortunately, they did not sue.
It reminds me a little bit of Henry Jenkins' convergence culture, the idea that George Lucas allows all of these parodies and things to happen around Star Wars because he knows at the end of the day, ultimately, it just builds fan culture even more. This is queers Disney. It's already kind of subtly queer, but this makes it overtly queer, the over-the-top nature of Disney and princesses and things like that. So it's pretty funny. And then you kind of extend that narrative from the Disneyland film into an extended travel and tourism narrative in your paper that you present. What was the name of your paper? And then kind of walk us through some of the themes and things that are covered in it.
Sure, and my paper focused on his travelogues, and I say that in the plural sense, but there really are probably two you can consider of his films to be travelogues. So it's not most of his work, but they are some of his feature films, so it's important to consider, I believe. And they are lengthy, around an hour and a half. And Marco of Rio was, I believe, the first. And then he did the One Adventure film, 1972, where he's documenting gay travel in Europe, specifically.
Yeah, you were talking a little bit before about some of the things they would do in these films, that they would travel to these exotic countries, kind of give you an idea of gay tourism, mixing in pleasure and politics at the same time.
Sure, and I'm wondering also if this might be one of the first film documents of early gay travel groups. We know that One Ink was doing travel groups from the 1950s on. By the time they hired Pat Rocco to be a part of the series and document this group's journey in the early 70s, they were already well established. The fees to go on some of these travel excursions were pretty high, in the $1,500 or more range per person. And so some of the questions that we should be asking are, like, who are on these trips? What are some of the topics they engage with? We know that they, at least in the film, met with at least three groups, local groups from different countries, as they were touring. And these were all gay organizations, homophile organizations. Yes, Rocco's films were screened at these meetings, and so all of the documents that we see in the film, there's a screen in the room with the gay groups. As they've already watched the films, they've discussed the films, Rocco is there to talk about the films, but then they go off and talk about politics, what it's like to be gay in that country. Is there anything different about the way one might act in Switzerland and Greece?
So there is a local angle as far as, like, what a gay lifestyle was, and what is the sexual angle in these countries? Is there nudity in these films?
Sure. So the film begins with Pat Rocco sitting with some of the leaders of the travel group, and I believe a few of the men that were there, one was Reverend Troy Perry. The other one was W. Dorleg, who was one of the co-founders of One Ink and also conducted the tour. And Chet Sampson was also in the group. So these men are discussing how the film is going to operate. It's not going to be just a documentary or a document of the trip, but it's also going to engage with nudity. And at one point after a screening, some of the gay men that have seen Rocco's film have apparently won the prize, which is five of them are now allowed to be shot in a Pat Rocco sequence, and it has to be nude. So they all disrobe. It's a pretty short little narrative that they enact of, I'm coming together and we're all going to be meeting each other and just having a gay romp. And so one by one, one person's in his room dancing nude alone to music, and then someone knocks the door. He comes in, quickly disrobes, starts dancing. Second, third, fourth, fifth person comes in, and then they all hop in bed. Finally, one of the guys turns to the camera as they're all not sexually engaged with each other. It seems like they're silly and kind of wrestling. One guy turns to the camera and says, "What a holiday," and exclaims, "It's so fun to be in this great vacation," right?
The men that were frolicking, were they as young and good looking as the boys in the Disneyland movie, or were they kind of just the regular people? Because you mentioned some pastors and some office officials that went on the trip.
The men on the tour were never seen in the film nude or in any of the small narratives, to my knowledge. There may have been one person on the tour that was involved, because there is one narrative segment where someone on the tour falls in love. Sitting at a cafe in Paris, he looks over at another person. His name is Jean-Pierre, and here's a Frenchman who's willing to take him around, show him the sights, and go to bed with him in the evening, and wake up the next morning to a cuddle session, is what we find them with Pat Rocco's camera. So it's pretty interesting.
But these were performers?
I wouldn't call these people actors in any way. It all looked pretty improvised, and I wouldn't be surprised if some of the people that they had met at the screenings were asked, would you like to be in the film? They were probably looked over head to toe. This is a cute individual. Would you like to be in a short narrative? It's just going to be an impromptu meeting. There's no script. Let's just walk around, tour Paris together, go up the Eiffel Tower, and I'm gonna have you talk for a couple minutes before you go to bed.
Well, that sounds fun. What a way to see Paris.
I have to add, go to bed meaning not showcasing intercourse or even any romantic fondling. It was completely just two men in bed, nude, talking romantically about what a great time they've had, what a great city this is, and how he looks forward to seeing them in the future.
And Brian, what paper did you present, and what were some of the things you talked about here at the conference?
So my paper, it's called Defining Homosexual Love Stories, Pat Rocco Categorization and Legitimation of Gay Narrative Film. And it's part of an article that I just published in Film Histories. And that work is about Pat Rocco and thinking about sort of the historiography of Pat Rocco and how we have come to understand him the way that we do and the place that he has earned in porn history and gay film history and gay representation history. My approach is a really discursive analysis to look at how Pat Rocco himself, and then also journalists at the time, and to a lesser extent also historians and scholars, have contributed to a very particular meaning and understanding of his films. And he's always been very careful with the way that he thinks about and describes his films, kind of manage a specific place in film history. And what he's most famous for is that he started making these films in 1968 is when he started showing them at the Park Theater. And that's right around the time that erotic film, both straight and gay in the US, was switching from softcore to hardcore. And he refused to go along with that switch because he really wanted to keep making softcore films. And the reason why he gave for that is that he felt if you are focusing on sex in a film, that you are precluding the ability to show romance and love, and for his films to have the uplift function that he wanted them to have for gay men who didn't have these kinds of representations, who thought badly about themselves because that's what U.S. culture told them to feel, and so that this was a way to reverse that. And he felt like he wouldn't be able to do that if he was doing hardcore films, because then they would just be about sex. Yeah, so even in the early 70s, he had already gotten this reputation that this was what made him different, is that he didn't make hardcore films when culturally filmmaking was going that way. And a really valuable resource for looking at this is this USC student in 1975 wrote a dissertation about the gay film industry in California and interviewed a lot of people who knew Pat Rocco or wrote about him or were making films at the same time. And they often talk about it with this sort of wistfulness that Pat Rocco just sort of got left behind with his sweetness and approach to gay sex while everyone else went to hardcore sex. And so my research then, I wanted to, look at how those discourses were built around him and the ways in which his films were very intentionally distanced from being porn and distanced from being avant-garde and other kinds of things, so that they are specifically thought of as homosexual love stories or gay love stories, and that's often the exact wording that was used about them, and really talked about as a kind of film that we haven't seen before. And that was a understanding of his work that obviously Rocco was happy to have, because it really made him sort of a vanguard. And there's this interplay between how he would talk about his films and how reporters would talk about his films, and they sort of fed into each other to create this axiomatic understanding of him, that this is the kind of filmmaking he was doing, something we hadn't seen before, when he was laying the groundwork potentially for more gay filmmaking that wasn't porn and that wasn't avant-garde, something that was going to resemble a little bit more Hollywood filmmaking.
So I guess when we think about the history of porn films, we think about the Beefcake magazines, the Athletic Modeling Guild, which are softcore. But, you know, since Pat Rocco is so close to the edge of when, you know, hardcore comes in, he kind of gets lost in the shuffle. So as a person who studied him and worked into the archive, should we consider him as part of porn history? I mean, there's nudity, there's not insertion. Is it just softcore? Or is there a new kind of broader categorization where he's documenting a certain segment of gay aspirational life?
So you brought up documentaries. He actually did make a handful of documentary films. He was kind of thought of as like LA's gay documentary filmmaker. Like I said, he would document that protest about that sign at Barney's Beanery. There were these events in Griffith Park that were gay inns that were sort of almost like little pride celebrations, and he would go there and record those, and he would record a groovy guy contest that was this male gay beauty pageant thing in LA. And so some of the filmmaking that we have, I think, of Harvey Milk and of early gay pride parades are stuff that he took. And so he was actually doing some of that, like documenting the politics of gay life in the late 60s and early 70s, mostly in LA, but then I think also a little bit in New York. About porn, that's one of the things that I grapple with, and I don't think ever have a hard and fast answer, so to speak, about what his placement there is. From what I've seen, he doesn't like the word porn for his work. He is okay with softcore for his work, because for him, softcore is distinct from porn, and a lot of my research is really chasing these fine classification and labeling things. And thinking about him in a history of posing and softcore, I think, is totally appropriate, because some of his films really are just like posing films, and some of them have this softcore narrative approach that I think some of Bob Meisner's films were later, and Dick Fontaine's films, where there is nudity and there is penises flopping around as people cavort through the forest, but there's often some kind of love narrative, if only expressed through like a lot of long glances. Sometimes there's even narrators. Matter of Life, it's about this hustler, and he actually is narrating his thoughts as he is a hustler in LA and what he wants out of life, and he ends up at the ocean at the end having this contemplative moment. And so this is one of the things that I talk about in my work, is that his work was really quite varied in a way that I think sometimes we forget when we just think of him as like, he was making softcore films and then stopped because everyone's making hardcore films. And he actually made a real range of films with different amounts of sexuality. Sometimes there's very little, there's just like a little bit of nudity, and then sometimes there's films that are just exclusively about having handsome young men romping around without really any story. And so the way that we remember him, I think, is often, it gets simplistic or a little bit reductive. perspective, which happens when you generalize about a filmmaker's life. So how to categorize him, I don't know. Softcore seems like a very easy way to categorize him. Hardcore seems like an easy way to not categorize him because he didn't have penetration and even erections, at least under Pat Rocco. He made a couple films under a pseudonym, Hardcore Films. But his Pat Rocco oeuvre, there was never any penetration. There was like simulated oral, sometimes from behind. There was like, you know, head bobbing, but we never saw anything. Thinking of him as softcore seems to me like the neatest way to classify him. But I would also argue, just for this diversity and the very nature of his work, that I think goes a little bit past any one category we would try to locate him in.
So you said something interesting there, though. You said that he did make hardcore under another name. What was his other name, and what are those films? Have you seen them?
So he made just a handful of films. I know of four under the name Brad Kingston, and he was making these for Jaguar Productions or Jaguar Films. I've seen it called a couple of different things. That was a porn distributor in the 70s that was started by one of the owners of the Park Theater, where Rocco had shown so many of his films. And yeah, these films, they're interesting to watch. I've only seen one of them. I've seen Come of Age, and you can buy that off the TLA website, I think, that it's actually available. It has distribution. In so many ways, it is the kind of films that we have seen from Pat Rocco, that it is like boys out in nature kind of frolicking around and story and that kind of thing. But then there's also hardcore sex. And people who have written about it often talked about it as like, this is one of Pat Rocco's lovey-dovey films, but just with a little bit of fucking sucking in it. And also critics at the time said they felt like his heart wasn't in it. And maybe partly they're just drawing off of what they knew about Pat Rocco and his persona, right? That, like, of course he wouldn't be into it because he likes sweet, innocent gay sex or gay love. It's a Pat Rocco film just with some actual unsimulated sex. And he doesn't like to talk about them very much. I've seen him in just one document I found in an archive where he'd written a letter to the Gay Erotic Film Awards in 1985. They were honoring him, and he was trying to help the organizer understand Rocco's placement in this chronology. Like, the work that we're doing, he also does a lot of that work very intentionally. And he did talk there a little bit that he did make a couple hardcore films, but he talks about it that it is not sort of representative of his work, that what he sees as like his important work is these homosexual love stories, these gay love shorts, and that's what he wants to be remembered for and where he thinks that he made more of an impact in a history of gay film.
I think one of the reasons why Pat has been a little bit lost to history is he's not quite at the emergence of a new kind of gay representation, and yet he's not as subversive as doing something as explicit as pornography. He's in the middle ground. And I think, especially in academia, this idea of what it means to be a gay filmmaker, what it means to be a queer filmmaker, means that you have to work towards doing something subversive, yet his films are highly conventional, like gayness is natural, love is natural, that's the end point of it. When we think about the travelogue films, and the politics of gay travel is very big in queer theory, the idea of gay travel and the pink dollar, and the idea of how gay travel is used to legitimize certain Western locations and delegitimize Eastern locations, especially the Middle East, the idea of the first season of RuPaul's Drag Race, you had Alan Chuck's gay travel where you travel to all these different locations. And so the idea of traveling to places like Israel. Israel is this great place where you can be gay, where you have all this barbarians and savagery around it that are anti-gay. You have the idea of traveling throughout Western Europe, America, or even Brazil as like this sexual haven, while the rest of South America is situated as this anti-gay place. So I wonder, is there a way to situate Pat Rocco's film? How could they be read today in a scope where the pink dollar and where you travel is emblematic of where, you know, sophisticated Western gay rights come to fruition?
Thinking of gay travel as really the boom in the 1990s is really important, that these were early groups. But also David Murray's writings are really important on this gay travel and tourism and creating a sense of gay identity abroad. And then also thinking through, importantly, at least from my own work, Jasmine Puir's work on homonationalism, consumption, queer tourism, and then kind of navigating these queer spaces like public gay intimacy and charting a potential space for homosexuals to be tolerated, but even more so living like an idealized, romanticized freedom is what at least Pat Rocco's travelogues attempt in some respects. And I was thrown aback because considering it from 2018, we're obviously going to ask questions of access, mobility, class, who was going on these tours, what was Rocco's framing mechanism for understanding something like Marco of Rio and Rio de Janeiro in the early 1970s. But I was also taken aback that in his interviews with locals during the One Ink film, let's say 1972, a lot of the questions that he asked the these individuals were about their lifestyle, obviously. Some were gay, some were straight men, but that they were always in conversation saying the U.S. is backwards. The U.S. doesn't have it right. These spaces have something we don't, and that's why you need to travel with us. It's worth the money to come to these spaces where you can be yourself in a more progressive society. And then the short narratives that he provides really idealize this, and with erotics, yes, but more importantly with a romantic ideal of being oneself as a gay man, and this specifically, obviously, a gay white man for his films.
Interestingly, back then, the U.S. has it wrong. Now, gay travel represents the U.S. has it right, and the U.S. allies are always right when it comes to gay rights. And if you don't agree with American foreign policy, then you're situated as an anti-gay, you know, barbarian. That's an interesting flip.
Yeah, to the question of Pat Rocco being subversive at the time or radical at the time, that's something that Whit Strub wrote about and was trying to think about how he became a little bit lost to history because we don't remember him in a radical filmmaking framework, because the way he describes it is that there was this insistence on gay happiness in Pat Rocco's films that Whit Strub would argue, and I would agree, that are very radical for the time, but it certainly didn't resemble the kind of queer filmmaking that we think of now with like Kenneth Anger, Jack Smith, or Warhol, or Shirley Clarke, or whatever. And what was radical at the time, it doesn't resemble the way that we think about what was radical. And so he kind of was denied this canonicity of being a radical queer filmmaker at the time, even though he was, I think, really resisting a lot of cultural ideas about gayness in the way that he made his films.
I want to ask Brian a question, because I have come across some of the scanned documents from the archive, and I've unfortunately not been able to travel to LA to see the archive myself, but there's a lot of documentation of Rocco's Spree Club, which seemed really interesting, that there was a large following. I don't know if you know anything about Spree, the Society of Pat Rocco Enthusiasts.
Society for Pat Rocco Enthusiasts, and there must be another E in there. Yeah, I don't know a ton about that. He would not like it called a Pat Rocco fan club. It came up around him, and I have a friend who's looked in the archive with that, and he says that there isn't as much as I thought that there was going to be there, but it was a couple different things at different times. Spree had like a gay Oscars, I think, in the early 70s, where they were trying to, again, in this way that Rocco was making films that could be thought of as gay correlates to Hollywood, that it was, you know, gay Oscars, that we were having our own industry and award structures that resembled what we were being blocked access to in the late 60s, early 70s. And yeah, it was also like a filmmaking organization. It had, part of its work was to help young gay filmmakers make films. And I think they would also do awards for the best films made by those Spree filmmakers. And Spree also helped reporters know how to talk about Pat Rocco's film. They would kind of feed them guides about this is what he's doing, this is what's new. And then the reporters would kind of pick that up and make it part of the history of Pat Rocco. And so they were also part of him managing that legacy around his work. So they function in a couple different ways.
I'll just ask you, since you're the distribution guy, where can we see Pat Rocco's films?
It is not easy to see Pat Rocco's films. I've only gotten to see so many of them because they're at the UCLA archive. I've been really lucky with that. I think there was a company called Cabin Films that has distributed some of his films. I don't know if it's legitimately or illegitimately. I don't know. You can maybe buy them from Pat Rocco directly. I think Matt may know more about this.
Yeah. I talked with Pat about this. He did ask me over the phone. He's like, would you like to purchase some of my films? He gave me his address. Here, write to this address and we'll send you some DVDs out. I think they did some conversions to DVDs in the mid-90s to the early 2000s. So they're not well done conversions. And they do have introductions by Pat Rocco on them as well. So he kind of tapes himself. I believe at the time he was in Hawaii. He's in his beautiful Hawaiian print shirt, outdoors, lush background, tropical, and says, I can't wait to show you these films. Here they are. So it's interesting that he, you know, positions himself at the beginning of these DVDs as well.
It's funny that you talk about talking to him over the phone. The Lincoln Center had a series of films. It was called Queer Cinema Before Stonewall, and they showed the Disneyland film from Pat Rocco. That's the first time I got to see it. And they had a phone interview with him after the film, and he was calling live from Hawaii. It was quite funny. And afterwards, he gave out his home phone number to everyone in the audience, and he said, if you ever want to call and talk to me about the history of the films, you can do that. Here's my phone number. And I could tell I was sitting next to a couple of NYU graduate students, and they were eagerly writing things down. So it's interesting, he's very open to talking to young people about his films and even sending them out if you pay for them.
Sure. And when I found one of his DVDs over the internet, in the DVD itself, there is a title card or a screen that has his number on it. So I said, what the hell? Let me try it. Gave it a ring. Someone answered.
Not his boy servant.
I'm not sure. He may have a secretary or an assistant. However, I also emailed, I think there's an email listing on the DVD as well. And the email was what I got in contact with his assistant first. And then Pat Rocco called me back after he learned what the project was. But Pat Rocco was very concerned about what we are writing. He wants to see works that are completed, and that makes sense. You know, wants to know how we're engaging with his works. And it's been an interesting process.
Well, thank you so much, Brian and Matt. This has been fun, and we'll look forward to maybe your scholarship leading to more stuff about Pat Rocco. That's great. Thank you so much, guys.
I want to thank Matt and Ryan again for being part of the show. You can find a link to Brian's article about Rocco in the show notes. Be sure to also check the show notes to find more writing about Rocco's work from the UCLA archives, as well as links to some of Rocco's publicly available films, which you can watch on YouTube. Some of the films include Sign of Protests, which documents the protests around Barney's Beanery and their sign, Faggots Stay Out. You're not going to want to miss that. It's actually pretty funny when you look at it in retrospect. Be sure to follow us on social media after you see all the films. You can find us on facebook.com/academicsex and on Twitter @pornocultures. Thanks so much for listening, and I look forward to getting sexy with you next time. Bye.